renewables is growing very fast in the region. But yes, there is, of course, also a role for fossil-based power, especially also gas, which will continue to play an important role, especially also here in faster-growing economies in Southeast Asia.
Competing against the Chinese industry is obviously on the agenda every day in the news. But on the other hand, maybe leveraging the strengths of China, attracting those investments and learning from the technology leapfrog of some of the Chinese players might be useful, particularly for Europe.
This is Business Insights, a podcast brought to you by global strategy consultancy Roland Berger.
Welcome to today's podcast about Asia's energy transition. My name is Dieter Billen. I'm a partner at Roland Berger based in Malaysia, and I lead our Asia energy practice. And we have the honor to have here also Denis Depoux, our global managing director based in Shanghai. And Denis, I know that this is also a topic that you're passionate about. Let's start with the first question about just energy transition. And as we know, Asia is the largest emitter also of greenhouse gas emissions, roughly half of global emissions. And everyone talks about decarbonization, but actually we should still talk about carbonization because Asia's greenhouse gas emissions are still increasing roughly 2.7% every year in the last 15 years. So relatively strong growth actually of greenhouse gas emissions still. Do you think that Asia will succeed in actually reducing its carbon footprint rather than continue the current trajectory of increasing greenhouse gas emissions?
Thanks, Dieter. Yes, I think so. I think Asia can do better. But first of all, yes, Asia is the largest greenhouse gas emitting region in the world. Basically, Asia is emitting twice as much as EU and North America combined. And actually, if you take China alone, China exceeded the emissions of the U.S. already in 2006. So that's a bit the trend. But why is that? Well, because North America, Europe, for example, have also exported their emissions in Asia, making Asia the manufacturing hub for the world. So in a way, since particularly China joined WTO in 2001, basically Asia, with China at the core, became the manufacturing powerhouse for the world, and that's generating emissions. The second thing is Asia is also a market. So it's home to almost 60% of the world's population. So, of course, that population and the growth thereof is generating emissions. The demand for energy is increasing. China's greenhouse gas emissions are 11 tons per capita in 2022. But that compares nicely, because these are developing countries still, to 17.9 in the US, for example. And of course, if you take that's a picture, but if you take the whole movie from the beginning, the inventory of historical emissions of Europe and North America, it's a lot more than China and India. It's 41.2 tons per capita in the US. It's 412 tons, while China is 249, and India is 57. So we need to put that in perspective and in the context of that region with a huge population, growing demand, and hence demand for energy, the manufacturing hub for the world, so basically outsourcing or insourcing the emissions of the rest of the world, represent 70% in Asia for the world. So of course, abating those emissions will be more difficult than in the rest of the world, and particularly versus Europe, which has been rather deindustrializing. Also, the pace of growth is very different. So if you look at Europe, is growing between, let's say, 0 to 2% this year, next year, following years, according to IMF. US probably 1 to 3%, while Asia is rather in a 4 to 6% range, 4.6% in China, forecasted for this year. Indonesia, Malaysia, around 4 or 5%, India, around 6%. Also, Asia is dominated by coal in its primary energy. So of course, that's generating more emissions. As a result, greenhouse gases emissions will actually continue to increase in the region, especially in these fast-growing emerging markets. But that is starting to change. you take coal in the primary energy mix of China. It went maybe 10 years ago, a bit more than 10 years ago, from above 60% to now 57%.
So in this context of increasing, at least for now, increasing greenhouse gas emissions in the region here in Asia, are governments here actually doing enough? And do you expect stronger government measures against climate change?
I think it's changing. It has accelerated over the past few years. So if we would have had this conversation 4 or 5 years ago, actually we had that conversation 4 or 5 years ago, the picture was not so encouraging. But since then, governments in the region have committed. They have committed to net zero carbon targets. Japan, Vietnam, Korea, Singapore, and Malaysia by 2050. China peaking its emission in 2030 and net carbon zero in 2060. Indonesia as well by 2060, Thailand 2065, and India by 2070. So, I mean, this is, of course, quite distant, but these are pretty strong commitments as we see elsewhere in the world. And if we take China, which is also the biggest chunk of those emissions, China has very ambitious targets and has taken measures. So, first of all, China is massively investing in renewable energy. More than 50% of the world renewable energy capacity additions in the next 5 years are expected out of China. Last year, 2023, 117 gigawatts of new wind power and 216 gigawatts of solar power. I mean, for the audience, France, my country's installed capacity is probably 120 gigawatts. So basically, last year, only wind power additions is basically the installed capacity of France, and this is continuing this year. In the first 6 months of 2024, actually, China installed 117 gigawatt of solar capacity. That's 15% of the global capacity in just the first half year of this year. And so China is on par to reach its target of 1,200 gigawatt of total solar plus wind in the end of 2024. It's also monitoring its emissions. So China finally set up and relaunched this year its emission trading scheme. So its carbon, its CO2 emissions credit market. Of course, with relatively low prices, $10-$12 so far this year, to be compared to the European Union, where it's more, let's say, $70 to $90 for a ton of CO2. Basically, China is gradually phasing out coal, but it's a mountain of coal to start with. So I mentioned the figures, 62 to 57%. That's a very interesting trend. But that's basically reducing the carbon intensity of 1% of Chinese GDP growth. It's been reduced by 15% roughly in the last 10 years. So I think that's a massive reduction, even though, of course, given the mountain of coal to start with, it will take time. But China has this very ambitious target, 2030, 2060, net carbon zero, 2030 peaking. And the government is throwing everything they have. So it's further hydro capacity, large hydro, smaller hydro. It's, of course, wind and solar. It's nuclear today, roughly 5%, a bit less than 5% in the mix, but to basically contribute 10% of the whole power generated in the country by 2035 and probably close to 20% by 2060. So it's a massive development, but of course, given the magnitude of the economy, it takes time. So now, I mean, I've talked a lot about China, which is close to my heart. But how about Southeast Asia?
Yeah, I think things have really changed in the last couple of years. Across the region, there's much stronger government push towards energy transition, decarbonization, increasingly more government support for decarbonization. But it's still very, I would call it very pragmatic, also with strong weights to affordability of energy and also security of supply. So as part of the energy trilemma, so increasing attention going towards the sustainability, decarbonization, but I would say in a pragmatic way. There's differences country by country. If we take, for example, Vietnam had a massive investment in renewables and especially solar in 2020, 2021. Actually, during the COVID period, there was driven by feed-in tariffs, government measures, very strong interest, global interest in investing in Vietnam's solar sector. And Vietnam emerged due to those 2 years as Southeast Asia's renewable energy leader, accounting for 69% of the region's solar and wind power generation by 2022. So there was a massive interest. Now, I think what has also happened in Vietnam is that the growth of renewables and especially solar was so strong that there were issues in terms of grid integration, curtailment. There's also issues in terms of the whole licensing and obtaining proper licenses in Vietnam. So there's a lot of issues that came out of that rapid growth, or you could even say too rapid growth. But that there was the particular case of Vietnam. I think going forward, given the issues that came with the very rapid growth of solar in Vietnam, I think the government is a little bit more cautious now, but has ambitious plans, especially for wind, where there is still a lot of untapped potential for wind, especially offshore. So that's Vietnam. If we move to Malaysia, I think Malaysia has always had a pragmatic approach. They have committed to a much stronger role of renewables, and actually the latest target is 70% renewables by 2050, but that's in terms of capacity. There's also a commitment of no new coal power plants in Malaysia, and Malaysia, and especially also Sarawak within Malaysia, is positioning itself also more aggressively when it comes to carbon capture, CCUS, as well as hydrogen production. And potentially, and this is also something across different countries in the region, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, will talk about that, potentially also nuclear and SMR. I think there's is also something that could be on the table in Malaysia. Singapore, let's move to Singapore, is of course driven by its small island state. It's small size, and hence there's not that much potential in terms of decarbonization. A lot of the renewables, rooftop solar, has already happened, and decarbonization will come mostly through renewable imports or imports of other clean fuels like biofuels or biomethane. Indonesia, I think Indonesia has been lacking in terms of solar, but has been very aggressive in terms of other types of renewables, such as hydropower and geothermal, in which is actually one of the front runners. But in solar has been quite slow. There's much more solar potential in the country. And I think Indonesia is a country that is so large and will need so much energy that there's also still fuel-based power being built naturally, and especially also gas. And here again, in the case of Indonesia, potential entry into nuclear and SMR, small modular reactors, that is being explored. Thailand, I would say, has already renewables, especially also on the solar side, where actually historically Thailand was an important solar country in the region. And now, I think importantly, it's also the first country beyond Singapore to have a carbon tax. So it has announced it will move to a carbon tax, which will be important, and we'll talk about it later, for decarbonization. So carbon taxes, I actually expect carbon taxes to be more broadly implemented across the region. So Singapore already has one. Thailand, as I just mentioned, has announced a carbon tax. And I think Malaysia is also moving into that direction. And that will make a lot of the decarbonization investments, will give them a stronger business case, of course, depending on how high these carbon taxes will be. And these carbon taxes are also being considered and implemented in the region, given also the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism, or CBAM, that the European Union is implementing. And I think the thinking by governments in the region is, why don't we tax carbon emissions here in the region and get the tax revenue from those carbon taxes here and use it for our own purposes rather than having it taxed for when it is being imported in the European Union. So actually, this carbon border adjustment mechanism by the EU is actually indirectly a driver of also carbon taxes here in Southeast Asia, and that will increasingly be the case. So in summary, renewables is growing very fast in the region. But yes, there is, of course, also a role for fossil-based power, especially also gas, which will continue to play an important role, especially also here in faster-growing economies in Southeast Asia. And as mentioned, the role of nuclear is being considered across several countries in the region. And Denis, I know you have a nuclear background originally. What do you think of nuclear in the region? Do you really think it's poised for rapid growth in Asia? And how realistic is it?
Well, Dieter, you're right. I started my professional life with EDF in China in a nuclear power station that EDF was supporting, and so that's close to my heart. You've mentioned pragmatism as one key feature of Asian energy transition policies, and I think it's very much like this. The governments are throwing everything they have to keep being competitive also on the decarbonization side, and you mentioned the impact of the carbon tax, and when you do this, basically you also have to throw in nuclear, and I'm quite surprised how in the last 18 months. Things have changed. I think that the nuclear discussion in Asia had been contained to obviously China developing a massive program with 400 gigawatts as a target probably by 2060 or as an expectation with Japan with of course plagued by the Fukushima accident with Korea that had a sizable share of nuclear in their energy mix, but that was it, right? And that has changed dramatically, I would say quite rapidly, because of the climate emergency. And so now, I mean, you and I have been seeing clients in the last couple of days in Thailand, in Malaysia. That discussion is everywhere. So everybody is interested, either as an input for people buying energy, or for energy industrials as a new opportunity. And that's happening in Southeast Asia. Several countries are considering it. Obviously, Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia. It's being now openly discussed. This is very new. There is also the idea of a technology shift, so going to small modular reactor as a proper solution for grid integration. So bringing quite some benefits because using less space, being dispatchable, having inherent safety features that are more Gen 4, as we say in the nuclear industry, type of features, and also being modular, so gradual scalability as opposed to very large projects that fit the very developed power markets, but are a bit more difficult for smaller power markets. So I think that discussion is happening. China continues. Japan, of course, is trying to slowly restart some of their nuclear plants pending authorization and public acceptance. It's a long journey. It's also, I think, an uncertain journey. Korea, obviously, I think the government change has sort of revived the nuclear ambition. And I think everybody understands that this is a no-brainer for decarbonization. Now, how fast can it happen is a question mark, because SMR is mostly on paper. Oh, it's blueprints. It's not necessarily there yet. Is Asia ready to have first of its kind? Is a question mark. Will the commercial expectations be fulfilled by all these projects remains a question mark. But I think there are a lot of expectations. I think the whole industry is boiling for the Asia opportunities. And it also fits quite some industrial requirements. Huh? So to also use some of the heat that is produced in industry, particularly in countries like we are today in Malaysia. Countries that have a big petrochemical industry and can use high temperature heat for refineries, for example, or for pulp and paper processing. So I think, yeah, nuclear has a revival everywhere in the world, but particularly here in Asia, and it will be a revival with new technology. But I've just alluded to some of the industrials consuming energy. So we've talked a lot about power generation, but Dieter, how is the outlook for decarbonizing heavy industries, abating CO2 emissions in hard to abate industries?
Well, hard to abate sectors like steel and cement. I think if we're honest, we don't see large scale decarbonization of these sectors at this stage in Asia, beyond some pilot projects, and especially without government mandates. And again, this is also where the carbon taxes or carbon prices play a role, because why would you invest a large retrofitting or carbon capture installation, which is very costly, we'll talk about that, if there's no price for carbon. So having governments and countries move towards mandates or carbon prices will be really crucial for these hard-to-abate industries. Otherwise, it won't happen at scale. What we see across Asia in terms of hard-to-abate sector decarbonization, I would say China, Japan, Korea are probably leading on this in the region. But it's still very costly and challenging to decarbonize at scale. Let's take, for example, cement. If you have to really decarbonize cement, carbon capture will need to play a role. For steel, it will need to be hydrogen or carbon capture. But all of these technologies, all of these pathways are still costly or even very costly, and hence will only be viable if they're enforced by the government through mandates or through carbon taxes. So carbon capture at a cement facility, for example, could be in the range of $150 per ton of CO2. So that's the order of magnitude we're talking about. And carbon prices will need to be in that range or above to make such investments viable. And we're very far from there in Asia. For example, in Southeast Asia, only Singapore has a carbon tax. And as mentioned, Thailand and Malaysia are moving towards one. But let's take the example of Singapore, which has a carbon tax. Singapore's carbon tax will be up to, and that's not decided at this point, will be up to $80 per ton of CO2 in 2030, which is roughly $67 per ton. And that's very high in the region. It's basically in the same order of magnitude of where the carbon prices in Europe are at this point. So it is high, but it's still very far from the $150 kind of range that is the cost of CO2 avoidance in some of these hard to abate sectors. So that's the big challenge of decarbonizing heavy industries. It's carbon capture. It's also hydrogen, but also hydrogen is very costly, not just to produce, but also to transport. And yes, we have a lot of governments moving into promoting hydrogen. We have a lot of corporate involvement also in terms of hydrogen production in the region. But really to create those offtake at scale will require stronger incentives or carbon prices. But that's for hard to abate industries, which is at this point still very challenging. But if we look at transport, Denis, Asia and especially China, where you're living, is leading. So why is China so advanced in clean mobility and especially EV? So in terms of decarbonizing the transport sector, or at least the passenger transport sector.
Well, you're right. China is very advanced. I think it's a result of industrial policy. You know, China is a planned economy, so industrial policy has a lot more power in China than anywhere else in the world. And I think there was this idea that, of course, other countries and companies, foreign companies, had been leading the internal combustion engine historically, and actually had a pretty high market share, I think close to 50% market share in China. And there was this idea that the next technology could be an opportunity to leapfrog and basically reverse that trend. And that's exactly what has happened. So a lot of government support to electrifying transport and electrifying passenger vehicles. And as a result, so if you take the first 6 months of this year, basically electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles represent 50% or more than 50% of the sales in China. And that's a lot more than, say, Germany, where it's less than 20%, or France, where it's a bit more than 25%. So it's there's a strong momentum, again, thanks to industrial policy, thanks to good products, which basically create a difference, create an appeal. So this is an extremely competitive market in China, with Chinese companies competing with each other, especially in a slowing down economy, in a tough market conditions. But so that creates a lot of stimulation, and that's all across the value chain. So it's the EV, of course, but it's also the batteries, it's also the charging infrastructure, and basically there's a whole ecosystem, there's a whole value chain that is being developed in China, and as we see, is also being exported. And in a way, I think this is also something we've seen in other energy transition related equipments, like the solar market, like the wind market. I think so. China has been dominating the solar PV market already for a long time. In fact, it's been dominating the wind turbine market for a long time, but somehow they were not exporting the wind turbines until recently, because the market was so attractive in China. And for large infrastructure projects like wind farms, basically, you also need for the financing, the turbines are certified, that their performance is certified, which is quite a lot of effort when you want to do it internationally. So the equipment manufacturers in China were not paying much attention. But of course, now that the market is a bit tougher and more competitive in China, they're starting to do this. So it's a pattern that we've seen in solar, we've seen in wind, we see in other energy transition related equipment, like electrolyzer for green hydrogen or for hydrogen production. So that's, of course, disrupting the markets elsewhere in the world. There's a strong pushback through import duties, through the Inflation Reduction Act in the US, also duties, taxes, tariffs in Europe, given geopolitical and sovereignty concerns. But it's a dilemma because, on the one hand, leveraging the strengths of China helps accelerate the energy transition. And in the short term, this is a way forward. On the other hand, of course, you may want to also leapfrog technology and make sure that Europe or America can still command some of these technologies. But Chinese equipment manufacturers generally, be it in the mobility industry or in the energy industry, are also willing to invest elsewhere. And they're investing in Europe. I think we did a study last year, I think in 23, the battery industry in Europe was generally invested at 25% by Chinese companies directly or through minority stakes. And that number is probably 10% higher this year with larger projects that have started to take off. So competing against the Chinese industry is obviously on the agenda every day in the news. But on the other hand, maybe leveraging the strengths of China, attracting those investments and learning from the technology leapfrog of some of the Chinese players might be useful, particularly for Europe. So, Dieter, how do you see the opportunity precisely in the equipment field for clean energy equipment beyond China in other parts of Asia?
Well, Japan and Korea have traditionally been strong in those sectors, for example, when it comes to batteries. But those are two countries that have really suffered from the rapid growth of China, not just because of cost, but as you also mentioned, and also because of Chinese innovation. I think it's important to recognize that Southeast Asia and India could potentially benefit from this tension. Southeast Asia and India could end up benefiting actually from, you can call it a tension when it comes to clean energy equipment between China and especially US and to some degree also Europe. In effect, because of those tensions, Vietnam and Malaysia have already emerged as the number two and number three producer globally of solar panels and cells worldwide. But of course, that's I would say it's a bit of a risky move for these countries to really position themselves as an alternative to China, because the danger is naturally import duties. And as, for example, the United States is aiming to develop those sectors also domestically, for example, when it comes to solar equipment, there are increasing import duties, not just from China, but increasingly also from other parts of the world, including Southeast Asia. So it is an opportunity, but I would say it's quite risky. And that's also exactly what we see right now with this increasing import duties in the US.
So where should we put our money? So where are the investment opportunities in Asia for private companies in the shorter term? Where do you see the hot markets?
Well, I would say, I mean, given that this is really a fundamental shift and we talked about it in this podcast, is really also accelerating the last couple of years. So naturally, that also brings plenty of investment opportunities. We just talked about the equipment side. In addition to that, I would say the biggest short-term opportunity is really investing in renewables capacity. Asia is expected to install more than 2.3 gigawatts of renewables just until 2028. So that's more than the total entire installed renewable capacity in Asia today. So more than that will be installed just in the next 5 years. So that's a big opportunity, investing in renewables. But of course, it's a very competitive business. So how do you make that more profitable, more appealing from a financial point of view is also to, at least for players who have the capabilities and interest to do so, is to combine those renewable assets with services, energy services, and ideally even tailored to specific client segments like industrials. But I would say also, for example, tailor it to data centers, commercial buildings, etc. If you do that and really provide the whole package rather than the renewable capacity, then it becomes a financially more attractive business proposition. And data centers, for example, is booming across the region. Malaysia alone, for example, has a few gigawatts of data centers announced. It's unclear whether all of these projects will actually materialize, but that's a very sizable opportunities. And those data centers will need energy, but also and reliable energy, but will also increasingly want clean energy. So that's a big business opportunity. So in the short term, new power generation across the region, especially naturally renewables, but combined with energy services and storage. Regarding clean fuels like hydrogen and hydrogen derivatives like ammonia or methanol, there will be demand for that, and especially in hard-to-abate industries or in transport sectors like the maritime sector. But a lot of that, and especially in the hard-to-abate sectors, which we talked about, a lot of that will need to be driven by government support. And without strong government support, there will be less offtake, and for example, also here in Southeast Asia. Biofuels is one area where we're doing a lot of work. There's a lot of investor interest in biofuels at this point across the region, and especially, I would say, in Southeast Asia. And I think that's also driven by sustainability and decarbonization, but also given Southeast Asia's abundance of biofeedstock. Let's take the example of biomethane. Biomethane is a very tiny market at this point, But there's strong investor interest. Why? Because biomethane is basically the same properties as natural gas. So you can use the existing gas pipelines. You can use the existing gas power plants. So it's a technology or pathway to decarbonize some of the gas power plants. And for example, it's cleaner. It's a cleaner pathway than hydrogen, for example. Of course, there's a lot of issues with biomethane, especially in terms of scalability, obtaining the feedstock, having it at scale. But these are types of pathways where we see a lot of strong interest, and that's also where the region can leverage some of the palm waste feedstock as well. For example, the biomethane from Pome, which is basically a waste stream from the palm sector. And then also finally, sustainable aviation fuels, clean marine fuels. I think that's also where we see very strong interest in this year, and this will continue to be a very important growth driver in terms of sustainability in the region, given Asia's dominance in terms of maritime sector, the transport sector, the aviation sector. Taking the example of Singapore, for example, they have recently imposed a levy on flight tickets, with which they then procure sustainable aviation fuel, and a lot of other countries in the region are also having increasing SAF targets or SAF mandates, sustainable aviation fuel. So that's also a very important growth market. So yeah, so I would say a lot of different opportunities ranging from renewables, energy services, tailoring that to particular segments and customer needs like data centers, but then also biofuels and sustainable aviation fuel. So plenty of different investment opportunities, Denis. And to conclude this podcast, Denis, are you optimistic or pessimistic about Asia's decarbonization?
Well, Dieter, I'm optimistic. I'm actually realistic because Asia has a very pragmatic approach. You said it yourself. And I would say more pragmatic than Europe and US. It's less ideological. It's driven by, it's simply driven by the economy. It's driven by the need to fulfill the growth in demand while decarbonizing. It's driven by maintaining competitiveness of Asia as the manufacturing powerhouse of the world. Climate performance is the new competitiveness, and somehow we're back to the competitive advantage of nations in terms of CO2 emissions. So Asia is throwing in everything they have with a pretty pragmatic approach based on what fits best the economic needs, what fits best also the availability of resources. I think in Asia, gas is well considered as the transition energy, and some countries obviously have it, and will have to import gas. But it's recognized that there is a need for a transition, and sometimes, you know, in Europe or that debate does not exist, and there is this dream that suddenly we'll go from a thermal industry, a thermal power generation, to a fully renewable power generation. This will simply not happen because solar and wind are not dispatchable; they're intermittent, and we need to manage that intermittence. So there is less green political pressure and again more economic drive in a pretty pragmatic way. Also in Asia, which generally speaking is dominated by strong governments that drive policy. So that's why probably they were late 5 years ago, 10 years ago. But they're picking it up, and they're picking it up more efficiently probably than more liberal economies. But there will be challenges. I think we've talked about nuclear. Again, it's not so easy to pull off a new nuclear reactors. There will be challenges because space is scarce, and sometimes, like, renewable energy is competing with food supply in terms of the use of space. But I think Asia is probably a bit more ready than the rest of the world to find a balanced mix that combines fossil fuel, nuclear energy when it's feasible, renewable energy when it's feasible, clean fuels, probably quite some effort on energy efficiency. We've not discussed this much, but I think there is very, very big potential. We see it in China with industrial modernization to reduce the energy intensity of industry, to reduce the energy intensity of residential and commercial buildings. So the transition, I think, in Asia will be longer, but easier, and probably with less disruption or political volatility as we see in North America or in Europe.
Okay, and those are encouraging words to end this podcast with. Thank you. Thank you, Denis.
Thanks, Dieter.
Thank you for listening to Business Insights by Roland Berger. Roland Berger is a leading global strategy consultancy. Our full-line service portfolio spans across all key industries and business functions. Established in 1967 in Munich, we are renowned for driving transformation, innovation, and business performance around the world. For more information, visit our website at rolandberger.com.